At this time, we begin the sick net.
I'm K2 Romeo, India Whiskey. My name is Dick. You'll also hear three other guys associated with the sick net. You'll be hearing John KC2WGB, who monitors the Echo Link if you had trouble getting through, and he also gives us the mailbag submittals. You'll be hearing from Paul WS2N, who gives us the space report. And there was a major space launch that was supposed to take place today that I think got canceled. So Paul will be telling us a little bit about that. And you'll also be hearing from Hal, K6DPZ, who's been playing with radio for 1,000 years, and he gives us the benefit of his experience. For those who have listened to the TechNet for the first time, I know you guys are tired of hearing this little introduction, but for those who are hearing it for the first time, the major purpose of the TechNet is for each of us to educate each other as to how radio really works. We feel it's necessary to do that because we want our own little slant on knowing the inside information as to how it all comes together. Good job. I'm convinced that the schools do a fairly poor job of teaching that material in the form of useful engineering information. The books do a fairly mediocre job of teaching it. So learning antennas, learning wireless techniques, how does transmitters and receivers and transmission lines and propagation, how does all of that really work? The 26 different kinds of ham radio, how do they all work? And nowadays you combine a computer with a piece of radio equipment, and boy, you get a combination that's just out of sight. When it comes to radio equipment, there are 6.8 billion cell phones in use throughout the world right now. There are more people in the world with a cell phone than have access to a toilet. Which is more important is an interesting question. There are certain countries where the population of cell phones is twice the population of the country. I think the United States has got something like a 120% coverage. There are nations out there that are close to 200% coverage with cell phones. And very few of us know that cell phone, one of its major developers, is a ham radio operator, Dr. Reed Fisher, W2CQH, of Bell Laboratories, way back in 1968. He's not the only one, but he's one of the major developers. And nobody knows that, if you know what I mean. Just like almost nobody knows who invented the microwave oven. Almost nobody knows who invented the Xerox machine. These are very unsung engineering heroes from my point of view. Okay, a person signs into the technical net. Let me drop. You sign into the technical net because you do have a question or a comment. You need not sign in simply because you're listening. That would be a very long list after 32 years of technical net. We now believe that people are listening. This is TechNet number 1542 of the TechNets that began in roughly September of 1982, 32 and a fraction years ago. And so I should have also told you that the menu we follow, that for approximately the first hour, we take general questions and try to give people slightly brief answers. I get rolling, and I'm not exactly brief all the time. I'm sometimes known to be pretty long-winded. People sometimes get an answer a little longer than they expected. After that first hour or so, John gives us a few of the more general interest subjects that were submitted to him by the mailbag. In other words, people who don't yet have the ham radio license, don't have the right equipment so they can talk to us. They communicate with John, KC2WGB, by pigeon dropping, snail mail, email, whatever. And we go through about three or four of those. That's followed by Paul, WS2N, who tells us what National Aeronautics and Space Administration has been doing. And along the way, from time to time, Hal T60PZ corrects our mistakes as to how radio really works. Let me drop. So if you do have a question or a comment, you're going to give me your call letters, your name, followed by the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment. A typical sign-in might sound something like this, W2BMP, Joe, and yes. Joe just happens to be the president of LIMARC, the group that runs this particular machine that covers the tri-state area of northern New Jersey, southern New York State, western Connecticut, and most of Long Island. So that plus Echo Link and IRLP gives us a particular repeater quite a bit of national and international coverage. And from time to time, we hear that people pretty far away listen into the TechNet. We've even heard a significant number of college professors will tell their students, listen to the TechNet to find out what radio is really like, or dial it up for the recordings. Let me drop this. There are two significant websites by Mike Number One and Mike Number Two, which give you information about the TechNet. Mike Number One is KC2 NJI, and he has a website that is www.amateurradio.tangovictor, amateurradio.tv. You go there, and the last 7 years of TechNet are recorded. You choose the right year, the right month, the right week, and it's in the 4 or 5 one-hour reels. You can play back all those past TechNets, thousands of hours worth of them. Mike Number Two is the one that has a website of limartechnet.com, and there you'll see all kinds of additional information about the TechNet, articles that go with it, pictures, and so on. So those Mike Number One and Mike Number Two sites combined with listening to the TechNet live, in theory, this is a fairly educational process. We believe that's the reason it has lasted this long. And as far as how long has it lasted, I'll give you one more word on that one. Let me drop it. Johnny Carson on The Tonight Show was on NBC essentially every single night for 30 years. You add up the total number of hours that Johnny Carson was on the air. You add up the total number of hours that this TechNet has been on the air. And there's a greater number of hours of on the air of this particular TechNet. And they're both very educational from different points of view, if you know what I mean. So lots of information out there. The fact that there's that much thirst for knowledge is what this whole experiment has really proved. N2FDJ and I, HIP, started the TechNet, TechNet Number Two, really, in 1982. Way back in 1975, there was a TechNet by, all of a sudden, can't think of his call letters. But there was a TechNet on Long Island from 1975 to roughly 1976. You could say this is TechNet Number Two. That was the Technical Net and Amateur Television Network, W2KPQ, Ed Piller. He ran the first TechNet, one of the founders of this particular club. Okay, give me a call letters and name right now, because you do have a question or a comment. K2LAW listening.
WB2AHK. Chet, yes.
W-H-Y-Y, Joe. Yes.
So far I've got Chet and Joe, and I know there was a double when Chet was signing it. Who was the other person?
A6DP3 with a quickie answers.
Which has already been announced twice, Hal. Very good. Was there another person trying to sign in? Give me your call letters and name right now. We have Chet, AHK, and Joe, RYY. Anyone to sign into the TechNet? Because they do have a question or a comment. Please give me your call letters and name right now.
N2XGN, after Paul, there is not too much traffic. Not necessarily related to ham radio.
I hear you, Wes. Okay, one last call. Anyone just check in, because they do have a question or a comment for the net. Please give me your call letters and name right now. Okay, maybe we'll have a light night tonight. Chet, you're number one on the runway. Take your time, because there's no big rush tonight. WB2 Alpha Hotel Kilo, if I got you right. K2RW, go right ahead with your question, Chet.
Okay, Dick. I'm redoing my 160-meter antenna feed system, and I might do it differently, so I have a question about that. Realize every antenna is different. Every situation where you're putting them are not the same as the next guy's, and there's no definitive absolute number. I'm just looking for a possible ballpoint guess. Ballpark guess. There you go. But here's my question. Let me let it drop. All right. What might be a reasonable guess as to what the feed point impedance might be on an off-center fed inverted V dipole fed at its highest point, 33% off the end, one end? Would 400 ohms be a good guess, Dick? Impedance, what do you think, Dick? Over.
Hey, interesting question, Chester. Don't think we've been asked that question quite in that form. And I can give you some rough estimates, and I can also tell you a place where you'll find out more information. If you go to Mike number 2's website, it's one of many places, and that's the one that's Limarc, L-I-M-A-R-C, technet.com. You'll find an article in there by K2RIW about impedance matching a dipole. Well, the main thing that you're looking for there is not necessarily the article itself, but there's two sets of curves, the so-called Brown and Woodward curves. The most smart ham radio operator-like thinkers, these guys were not hams, but they should have been, way back in 1947, Mr. Brown and Mr. Woodward, and I think they worked for Bell Labs, chose every possible dipole or monopole, you could say, every possible length, every possible diameter, and went and really measured the impedance. Didn't use theory to derive it. They really measured it, the resistive component and the reactive component. So once you know, let me drop it. Once you know how long your antenna is on each side, so now it's really going to be a half-wave dipole, but because you fed it off to one side, it's not a quarter wave on one side, it's quarter wave on the other side, it's really 50% more than a quarter wave on one side and 50% less than a quarter wave on the other side. Therefore, each individual side, by way of the Brown and Woodward curves, will tell you exactly what is the reactance and what is the resistive component of the impedance. And you take those two numbers and you combine them. Be careful now what I mean by combine them. Let's assume now that the long side, according to the Brownwood curve, told you that the resistive component is going to be 200 ohms, and the short side, according to the Brown and Woodward curves, is going to be 50 ohms. So therefore, you combine by adding the resistive component. 200 ohms on the right side, 50 ohms on the left side, would give you 250 ohms total of resistive component. Now, if you were lucky enough that the right side happened to be inductive reactance by 150 ohms, and the left side was capacitive reactance by 150 ohms. The nice thing about capacitive reactance and inductive reactance, one is called positive and one is called negative, is they cancel each other. So when you're adding the impedance of the right side and the left side, you take the resistive component, you simply add it, and the reactive components, as long as it comes out opposite in size, you subtract them. And what's left over is what you're going to get. So that's one way you could predict. Let me drop. And we all think that because our dipole is some number of feet above the ground, some number of feet against the away from the rain gutters of the house, some number of feet away from the nearest building or the nearest set of trees, we all think that it's going to make a huge change in the impedance. It makes a change in the impedance. My experience tells me that change is usually fairly minor. On top of that, most of us nowadays either buy or have built into our rig an automatic antenna tuner, or you've got a separate antenna tuner, or you could build an antenna tuner. And even if you don't want to build an antenna tuner, you borrow from somebody an impedance measuring device, an antenna analyzer, and you really measure the impedance. And then you go to the Berkeley formula. You simply Google the word Berkeley, B-E-R-K-E-L-E-Y, plus impedance match. You Google that set of words, and out comes the Berkeley equation, the Berkeley website, so to speak. You tell it what impedance your antenna has, what impedance your transmitter has, which of course is usually going to be 50 ohms resistive, and what frequency you're operating at, and Berkeley will give you 16 answers to that problem. You take this inductor and that capacitor, and it tells you exactly how many microhenries and how many picofarads, and you combine them as an L network, a T network, a pi network, choose whichever one of the solutions you want. Mount that device at the center of your antenna, and now the impedance going down the feed line will be 50 ohms. Let me drop. That's one possible approach. Another possible approach is to simply, with a balloning device, connect the coax, connect open wire feed line. The people who are really serious on 160 meters will sometimes use open wire feed line, which can easily be homebrewed. Now, no matter what the heck the impedance of the antenna is, no matter how high the visoir is, open wire feed line is so low in loss on 160 meters that it doesn't matter. You do the impedance matching in the shack by either the Berkeley equation or a wide-range antenna tuner, and the problem goes away of impedance matching. So you can estimate it by the Brown and Woodward curves. You can really measure it. You can say, hey, this is just academic. I'm going to use low enough loss feed line like open wire line, and no matter what the heck it is, I'll do all the matching in the shack by a wide-range antenna tuner or by the Berkeley equation, and I wind myself an inductor, and I get a transmitting-grade capacitor, and that even can be homebrewed, by the way, and make an L network, we'll say, impedance matching network from the Berkeley equation, the Berkeley website. So lots of ways you can feed it. Impedance matching the antenna, as you're about to find out, Chad, is something we all lose sleep over the first few times that we build an antenna for a particular band. You've never done it before. And when it actually comes to doing it, you'd be amazed how easy it is. And even if it doesn't work at first, you tell your friends that, I run out of range on my antenna tuner. I've gone to the maximum capacitor on the variable capacitor, and I've run out of range, and I didn't get a good match yet, if you know what I mean. You tell somebody what your failure is on a group like this, and they'll tell you exactly where to go. And another thing to know about, let me drop. If your particular brand name of antenna tuner was giving you enough data, if he was giving you a real good engineering useful information data sheet, he would show you a Smith chart. A Smith chart is just a circular chart where every possible impedance of resistance, reactance, conductance, susceptance, every possible impedance of any kind of a dummy load antenna, amplifier, whatever, is somewhere on that chart. And as such, your antenna tuner, no antenna tuner has complete range. You could color in a portion of the chart as to where your antenna tuner will operate, and don't color in the part where you don't think it's going to operate. However, your particular real antenna is a dot somewhere on that chart. And if that falls into the bad section where your antenna tuner can't handle it, that's not a showstopper. You just add or subtract transmission line between you and that antenna. That doesn't change the visual of the antenna. It just takes your compass, where the sharp point of the compass is in the center of the chart, and the pencil starts off on your dot, and you rotate that compass and draw a circle on the Smith chart. As your transmission line becomes shorter or longer, you're simply operating on another portion of that circle you've just drawn. So by adding the right amount of transmission line, and even that doesn't have to be calculated, you can experiment, you'll now move the dot of your impedance of your antenna from the bad section to the good section of the chart where your antenna tuner can handle it. So there's lots of ways of skinning this cat, as you can tell. I probably have created a couple more questions with this information. I didn't give you an exact answer, but you being a scientist, Chet, I've given you enough information to start doing a further investigation.
Repeater, timeout.
Let me double check that we still have the Eastern repeater. We do. So you can use this information to start the next step of investigation. You're allowed to come back every week you want to for the next couple of weeks and ask us more questions, because your problem is a fairly common one, and a lot of people out there are not smart enough to ask it the way you did, Chet. The B2AHK, I'm going to say the VHF, Voice of Flora Park, K2RIW, you got it, Chet.
Okay, very good. Well, I've had this antenna up for about this particular one about 5-6 years, and everything was good, except now I'm running it on AM service, full legal limit, and my Bowen apparently arced over at the top. I'm using the 4-to-1 Bowen coax fed from the shack. I was getting something like at the transmitter, like 2.5-to-1 SWR, and I use an antenna tuner to bring it down to where I can operate the low SWR using the antenna tuner, but the 4-to-1 Bowen arced over. I have to run lower power now. I can't run the full legal limit. So I'm redoing everything, and I just discovered I have in stock some window line, 14-gauge window line, 450 ohm, 125 foot of it. And I was thinking of, rather than changing that, the Bowen to a heavier duty one. And by the way, the antenna's working great, big signal. I was thinking of changing the configuration since I found the material tonight. Ladder line, 450 ohms, which I'm guessing it might be. And I was going to, at the bottom, I was going to put the new Bowen, 4-to-1 Bowen at the bottom on the ground level. I was just wondering if I could go that way or just replace what I have up there with a heavier duty 4-to-1 Bowen, which did work for 5 or 6 years. As I said, I'm running full legal limit on 160 AM. It's a different kind of service from CW or SSB. So I was just thinking that rather than go and just replace what I have, is change it.
Repeater, timeout.
Okay, I was just thinking of just changing the whole configuration and using window line, very high quality window line, and my tower is 125 foot high, so I have to, I don't like standing up on top of the tower for too long. It's easy to hook up a window line to the existing radiator up there, and with an outrigger, bringing the window line off the side of the tower about 3 or 4 feet off, so there's no coupling to the tower. And at the ground level, hooking a new Bowen, where it's easy to hook up down there on the ground level, rather than engineering and working up in the sky. So that's what I was thinking. I'm not sure if I'm going to go and just replace what I have, or build something different. I have a suspicion that I might be better off using the window line, rather than running a 200-foot of coax all the way up to, from where the transmitter is all the way up the tower, to where the Bowen would be at the top of the tower, to the center-fed inverted V. Trying to make my life a little easier, rather than standing up there for hours trying to replace a Bowen and soldering in the wind up there. Well, back to the next one up there is RRY. But thanks a lot, Dick. I appreciate it. We wrote everything down there, and we'll consider all the things that you mentioned there. So back to TechNet. This is WB2AHK, the American Ham Kid in Floral Park.
6 DPZ for a comment.
Yeah, I heard DPZ and another person. DPZ, go right ahead with your comment. And Chet, don't go away. Oh, I've got a couple of questions for you, and I got a couple of suggestions. Let's see what Hal's got to say. K6DPZ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, I checked on K6DPZ. Okay, first question I have for you, Chet. Are you using this just on one specific frequency, on a fast break, yes or no?
Yes. The answer is yes.
Okay, you don't need to use a balance. You can make a line section to transfer the impedance from what impedance is the feed point your antenna to any other impedance by using a Q line section. And that way it's on a specific frequency. It doesn't have to be broadband. And you can change your impedance from one impedance to another and go down the road. Go ahead, Mr. RIW, with your comments.
Yeah, he called it a line section impedance matcher, and I think he's talking about a quarter wave matching transformer out of transmission line, and they work very well. And they are reasonably broadband and very forgiving. You've got two or three other approaches here, Chet. Assuming now you've got coax going up to the antenna right now, and you had a 4-to-1 Bowen that did give you grief. And you might not necessarily have to have a balun there, although you can also homebrew. You can make a 4-to-1 balun, 4-to-1 impedance matching balun, out of a half wavelength of coax cable. You take a half wavelength of your favorite high-power coax cable, bend it into a U-shape, connect the shields together, take your regular transmission line going up to this thing and connect all three shields together. The half-wave looped piece of coax balun, coax cable, that goes to the two sides of the dipole, and just one of those sides goes to the transmission line, center conductor to center conductor. That is a 4-to-1 impedance matching device. And assuming you're using the right kind of coax cable, that'll take lots of kilowatts of power. Yes, you have to make it a half wavelength long with the velocity factor of the transmission line for that U-shaped piece. Let me get up. But if you actually swept that 4-to-1 coaxial balun across the whole 160-meter band, you can see very little change of visuar at the two ends versus to the center where you designed it, if you know what I mean. That's an extremely broadband device. Another way, if you could tolerate the... And by the way, that would give you automatically from 50 ohms to 200 ohms, that 4-to-1 balun, which gets you pretty close to what the antenna probably really is. You could also do a poor man's balun by making a certain number of turns of your coax cable held together with a black tape right near the antenna. That's a kind of an RF choke to make sure no RF current flows down the outside of the cable. And that's another kind of very high power balun. And then if you do decide to use your 450 ohm open wire line, let me drop it. And you bring it all the way down from the antenna to the shack. And then at the shack or wherever you want to make the transition, use one of these coaxial cable type half-wave coax balance that I just described, which does, by the way, a beautiful job of matching unbalanced to balanced, and also a 4-to-1. Because it gives you twice the voltage, at one instant of time, positive voltage is coming out of your transmission line, and you're injecting positive voltage both into the right side of your open wire line and the right side of your U-shaped piece of cable. The left side of the cable, a half wavelength away, will have a negative voltage of the same magnitude, and so the two, positive and negative, are twice voltage apart from each other, which is a 4-to-1 impedance match, if you know what I mean. So you build the half-wave coax balun. You can put it up at the antenna if you like, and feed it with coax. You can put it down at the ground if you like, and feed your coax up to it, and then open wire line from there. So you've got lots and lots of choices here. Now, you said some magic words to me. Let me drop. 125 feet of tower. Whoa. You have one of the tallest towers on Long Island. And you live in Floral Park. How did you do that, Chet? And how long have you had that tower? I get the impression you've had it there for some time. So you're one of the serious tower people. And you and I have got to talk someday. So give me some words about what kind of tower, and to put a 160-meter inverted V on a 125-feet of tower. By my standards, you're pretty serious top bender. WB2AHK, KQRIW, go ahead, Chet.
Well, I've had this tower up about, I don't know, 10, 15 years, but it's in Queens. It's in Queens at my old working location, my old salt mine. And I sold the property about a year and a half ago, but the guy who bought the property let me stay there. I have four towers over there. And he let me have my ham shack, and he gives me electricity. He likes me. A likable guy, I guess, or something. And the Long Island Railroad, which is right behind my building, actually, I have a letter from the president of the Long Island Railroad. They have a tree on their property. They pruned it. And they were pruning trees in the area, and they pruned this tree into a totem pole for me, and they reattached my longer length of my 160 antenna to the top of the tree. I have a letter from the president of Long Island Railroad saying that ham radio operators are public service orientated, help out in emergencies, and they were very happy to accommodate my antenna, my end of my antenna for my 160 antenna coming from the top of the tower. And the other end goes to my other towers, towards my other towers. So I'm a very lucky guy. I operate remote. I use a UHF link. Been doing that for 20-something years. And fell in love at 160 meters. I've worked all the bands from there. Had rotating antennas and all kinds of bells and whistles over the years. But for the last 18 years, I've been operating 160 meters. And I love operating on AM. We operate, in case anybody wants to listen, we operate on 1.885, 1885, and I work very well.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
I work very well into the Northeast, mainly New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Connecticut, Rhode Island, New Hampshire, Maine, and I go down to... in a good condition down towards Maryland. So the antenna really works good. So I've been operating legal limit though, and I think I stressed the bowing up there, and I must have made a RF trace on the toroid on it. It's still up there, but I've been working on over the weekend here, we're getting ready to replace it. But then I came across the window line, so I was thinking of maybe using window line instead, bringing that down from the tower rather than just repeating what I have. If it doesn't work as well as what I have now, I will put the ballon up. I'll leave the coax up there and just hook the new ballon, and I'll be back in business. Over to you, Dick, WB2AHK.
Very well done, Hutchin. You've got some friends. My goodness. And the Loretta River will trim trees for you and reestablish antennas. You got friends. Well done. And remote operation all of those years. When I look you up on QSZ.com, you're 5 years younger than I am. But you've been moving right along, I can tell. Sounds like you're enjoying it. I still do my tower climbing, and so do you. But the right kind of safety equipment. And by the way, I've done some of my best work in the wintertime. Not when there's snow or ice on the tower, though. That we shouldn't do. But with the right kind of climbing equipment, you can make the process pretty safe. Very well done. We got to keep track of you, Chet. And so, out of curiosity, what's your best DX on 160 meters over all the years you've used it? Or another way of telling us how well you're doing. How many countries, how many states? So tell us a little bit about the 160 meter band. Of the guys that sign into this TechNet, I'll be amazed if more than a handful of them have ever even heard 160 meters as well as use it. So you're one of the rare birds that's using what they call the top band. Top band, when you look at it wavelength-wise, it's the lowest frequency popular ham band, or the one with the biggest wavelength. So what kind of DX and states and countries have you heard and/or worked, Fred and Chet? And maybe you're even seeking a DXCC on 160 meters. WB2AHK, K2LAW in the TechNet.
Much to your amazement, everybody else's possibly, I don't work DX. I don't know how many states I worked. I don't have any idea, but I'm a rare cure, mainly transmitting to my buddies in those states that I mentioned. And I don't even look around on other frequencies at all or for DX. Now, somebody that can give you a good idea is on the repeater right now, K6DPZ, who has hooked up a high tower and operated 160 last night. And he worked, South America on 160? Maybe he could tell you, Dick. Why don't you ask how he's working, how his new antenna is working out from Oceanside. What do you think, Dick, over?
Yeah, that Oceanside location of his, a saltwater reel nearby with a real good ground plane, I think it's starting to really shine. Tell us a little bit about 160 meters, Hal. K6DPZ, K2RIW in the TechNet. Maybe Hal got called away. And another response there, you're my kind of people, Chet, because when I put up that really big antenna on 432 megacycles, 16 Yagis on the top of 100 feet of tower. And when you go to Mike number 2's website, that's the one that's limarktechnet.com. Right on that first page, you'll see a picture of me standing in front of that 16 Yagi antenna. 16 feet wide, 15 feet high, 13 feet deep. That's 3,500 cubic feet of antenna assembled at the top of that tower. So that's capable of some real good DX, like moon bounce. But the majority of what I did with it, it's the same thing you did, Chet. Talk to my buddies and pick their brain. In the case of 432, in the days when I was doing that, late 70s, early 80s, the average guy got on 432 with high power with homebrew equipment. So each guy you talk to was using a different kind of transmission line, different kind of antenna, different kind of tower, different kind of transmitter. I was using a strip line parallel kilowatt amplifier, if you know what that means. April and May, QST, 1972. You can read about it. Anyhow, that high-power kilowatt amplifier allowed me to talk to people in, I think it was 28 states. But the main thing was not necessarily achieving X and running up states and collecting cards. I liked picking people's brains. In other words, I would talk to each one of those guys and find out what they're building, what worked for them, what didn't work. And one of the people that I frequently talked to was Dr. Reed Fisher, W2 Charlie Quebec Hotel, who was one of the primary inventors of the cell phone. So talking to people was a lot of fun. Keep up the good work. Come back next week and tell us what you decided.
Repeater, time out.
As I'm starting to say, Chet, come back next week and tell us what you decided to do and how well it's working. And I presume you use sideband on 160, but I'll bet you there are some guys that just love amplitude modulation on a certain frequency on 160. Is that true, Albright Chet, WB2AHK, K2RIW?
WB2AHK, I just use AM for the last 15 years, and I have capability to operate sideband and move around the band, but I just stay on one frequency. I like building and putting things together. If anybody has a way of looking at November 2012 CQ magazine, November 2012, I'm on the front cover with my boat anchor remote station. I had three transmitters going, two amplifiers, all switchable by remote means. And I had several boat anchors running there, Valiants and Rangers. And the way I had it going, I had motor drives controlled by touchtone by remote linking on a UHF frequency. I was able to turn the modulation pots by motor drives and the VFOs by motor drives, controlled by touchtone. An interesting thing that I do, because I'm only 7 miles away from my transmitter, is I'm full duplex. That means I transmit and receive simultaneously. I hear myself, so I can adjust my signal. I know when things are good or bad, and adjust my audio. I hear myself with the cans on. So I'm full duplex on 160. 160 is a nighttime band, dark, you know, when the sun goes down. However, I do a lot of testing during the day, and I've been reported by other hams to be heard hundreds of miles away during the daytime, or 100 mile away on the daytime, with good signals as I'm, you know, saying test, 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 test. You have to be careful. There's always somebody listening on ham radio. So I've gotten QSL cards from hams saying, hey, don't you listen? I've been calling you. I hear you. I'm 100 miles away, and you're going test, 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 test. So, it's fun. I like building. I like
repeater. Time out.
I like building, and I like putting things together. And I do less talking and more playing. So that's what I do. I like toys. I'm a toy man. Over to you, Dick. WB2AHK, American Ham Kid.
Very well done. That you can run a full duplex over that 7 mile remote base, 160 meter. And high power AM, but you've got a good looking amplitude modulation transformer. I bet you that weighs a good 100 pounds, if you know what I mean. to run a full gallon. I think you have to develop 500 watts of audio if you're using high-level plate modulation. 500 watts of audio, and so that's a good-sized transformer. Maybe even 813 tubes. I'm making some guesses here. So you operate full duplex. You can hear everything you're transmitting on 160. Do you know anybody who operates full duplex on 2-meter FM, Chet? Have you ever known anyone that does that? Over to you, Chet.
That's easy. I'm doing that right now. That's what I do when I drop, you know, I timed out. You too. You're probably doing that. There you go.
Can you hear what I'm saying to you?
Yes, I do. Sure. Of course. That's the only way to operate. I got so used to being a duplexer. That's the only way I operate. All right. Just so everybody knows, I got rid of all my hollow state equipment at the remote. I'm solid state. And I operate, my transmitter runs full legal limit. It can, it runs conservatively 375 watts carrier, 1500 watts PEP, but the transmitter is capable of putting out carrier well over 1000 watts. Let's turn a little pot on the front panel. And make a long story short, this transmitter is a Class D David transmitter. It's in a rack panel, and it weighs 8 pounds and draws 5 amps, has a 5 amp fuse from the AC line. That's technology. That's what I use. The audio on it is absolutely superb, so that's what I operate now. I finally went solid state on my AM equipment. K2RIW and the TechNet, WB2AHK.
K2RIW.
Yeah, Matt recognized. Chet, wow. Where did the design of that transmitter come from, Chet? Over to you on that one, Chet.
K7DYY. Let's go with Google search, K7DYY. And I use the transmitter that he senior. I had four. Senior K7DYY. That's the call letters, and he makes these things. Not as a sideline, but he has sold hundreds of them. Maybe have a break of this. Might be interested in something that we're talking about. So back to you, Dick Coleman.
Yeah, I've got to go listen to 1885 kilohertz and hear some of these hi-fi broadcast transmissions, if you know what I mean. Go right ahead with your question, Matt. KC2YDT, K2RAW.
Hey, Dick, I'm not going to go into full detail, but if you could just add me to the list of questions for tonight. Just a late checker.
You're on the list, Matt. And now the serious guy who's going to give us another one of those technical challenges is Joe, WB2RYY. Is it WB2RYY? I'm not terrible on call letters here. Where the hell did I write that down? My goodness. Joe, you know who you are. Take over, Joe. K2RYW in the Tech Den.
You always confuse me with Richie. He's WB2RYY. I just, one letter less, WB2RYY. I was going to say, do you want a difficult question or an easy question, but it's just, I think I'll just requalify it. It's a non-radio question, okay, and it has to do with heating systems. Are you ready for that category?
Yeah, particularly oil burners. Whenever we discuss oil burners, boy, we get lots of replies from people saying, give me all that extra information. Go right ahead, Joe.
Okay, very good, Dick. Let me put the courtesy tone goodbye. I don't know much about gas systems, gas-fired systems, but I was just trying to, I had a conversation with somebody, and I didn't really have the right information to be able to tell them specifically, because I don't know a lot about gas-fired systems. But comparing to my own oil burner, which is rated for, say, I think 151,000 BTUs, I guess that's per hour, using a 1.25 gallon per hour nozzle. How would you equate that to a gas-fired system? Because we were talking about, you know, what's more efficient and what's going to cost you less to run. And I don't really know much how I can say something about gas-fired systems, because it's kind of hard to equate it unless you happen to know specifically, more specifically, with a gas-fired system. To get, say, like the same equivalent number of BTUs, it's going to take so many cubic feet per hour of gas to burn to be able to get that. And that's what the discussions pretty much came up with, you know. But I don't know the specifics about gas. So maybe you can fill us in, Dick, comparing it to oil. What do you think? K2RW?
Yeah, I hope we have a gas expert on frequency, because I'm rather light on gas specifics. In the case of a gallon of oil that is properly atomized, oxidized, and thoroughly burned, a gallon of oil gives you around 120,000 BTUs, 1 gallon of number 2 fuel oil. And as long as your furnace is working reasonably well, your oil-fired furnace, so that 120,000 BTUs gets converted, gets coupled to your boiler. If you've got a hot water system, or in my case, I've got what they call a warm air system, it gets coupled to my plenum box and gets blown into the ducts of my house. Also, because the particular furnace that I purchased, the flue pipe came out the wrong side. And so I installed some great big flue pipes. I guess it's around a 6 or 8 inch diameter. I'm not quite sure what the diameter is. But I made the U-turn out of elbows and whatever. So I've got a great big long flue pipe in my house before it goes to the chimney. Therefore, any heat that's left over comes off that hot flue pipe, because my flue pipe has very little soot inside, because I've got such complete combustion. I make sure I've got the right fuel-air ratio. And I don't get black soot in my flue pipes. I get a tan-colored shale. You know, there's always a little bit of mineral matter in your oil. And after a couple of years of running, you get this mineral matter depositing a very thin layer of it on your flue pipe. So whatever heat is left over after the flue gases leave my furnace goes through this great big long flue pipe, and it gets coupled into my house. So the total number of gallons per hour I burn now compared to when I moved into the house is almost a 2-to-1 ratio. Let me drop. Now, people who have a natural gas furnace also are, if it's properly adjusted, they're completely burning that gas. And so as they mix it with the air from the house, and that flame is giving you all the heat that gas is capable of giving, hopefully a high percentage of that is coupled into the hot water system, if it is hot water. I think most gas-fired systems are hot water, and then therefore it's being distributed in your house. Now, the missing piece of information is that the natural gas that we burn, how many BTU comes out of each cubic foot of gas at normal standard temperature and pressure, so to speak, and what is today's price in dollars per therm, or dollars per thousand cubic feet, however you buy it. So when it comes to figuring out which is more efficient, let me drop. You got at least two different ways of looking at efficiency. I mean, you can look at how many BTUs of real heat capacity there is in natural gas versus the heat capacity that's in a gallon of number 2 fuel oil. That's one way of looking at efficiency. And what percentage of that through your particular furnace gets coupled into the air of your house. Another way of looking at efficiency is that once you include the efficiency of the furnace, and now you're getting down to what is today's current price in BTU, in dollars per BTU, you eventually, if you do enough research, you'll find out how many dollars you have to spend to get how many BTUs of heating capability of the fuel that you're buying, whether it be number 2 fuel oil or natural gas. So there's at least two different ways of looking at efficiency. I wonder if we have some gas experts out there that can either tell us the two main pieces of information we're missing right now, which, by the way, I'm sure you can Google it. How many BTUs do you get out of a standard volume of natural gas, and what is the current price of natural gas in dollars per that volume? Anybody with any information along those lines, give me a call. Let us right now. K2RIW in the TechNet. Yeah, part of what's going on here is that Joe and I are some of the fairly rare guys. Let me think down. Why can't I think of Erwin Dresner? Why can't I think of Erwin Dresner's call letters? A guy who is a K2... what Erwin Dresner's called it. He's now a silent key, but he's one of the very early members of LIMOC. He, as you may have heard me say before, had a contract from Brookhaven Laboratories, Brookhaven National Laboratory, to investigate the efficiency and setting characteristics of the oil burners on Long Island. And he found that a high percentage of them are being quite misadjusted, with a very rich fuel-to-air mixture. They're making a very smoky flame, rather inefficient. And there's the conflict of interest of the guy who's selling you oil is the guy who's adjusting your furnace. Therefore, he has a high motivation to adjust it in an inefficient way so that you burn more oil, so that he sells you more oil, if you know what I mean. And so he found a high percentage of the furnaces are not being well set. A lot of people have got some very negative opinions about oil, and that's really an unfair decision as to how clean and quiet oil can be if it was running correctly. And an awful lot of them are not running correctly. Quite a few of my friends that I visit who are heating the house with oil have a very loud, rumbling furnace. It doesn't have to be that way. Let me drop. But what I'm getting at is maintaining your oil-fired or gas-fired furnace is not rocket science. A high percentage of the population thinks that, hey, this is a high technology, this is dirty work, I don't want to be involved in it, and therefore I'll buy a contract and I'll have somebody else do it for me. The smarter kind of ham radio operator is willing to open up the cabinet on his ham radio rig and replace the fuse, fix the power supply, and by the same token, he's willing to change the nozzles once a year on his oil-fired furnace, change the filter once per year, and make sure he has a spare ignition transformer so that if 2 o'clock in the morning on Christmas Eve his furnace fails and the house is getting cold, he has the ability to fix it. And we amateur radio operators, quite a few of us, like having the pride of being able to maintain our equipment, whether it be our antenna, our transmitter, or our furnace. So, as I said, it's not rocket science. If you go to a good store that supplies you the raw materials to do this, Sid Harvey, sitting on the shelf at most Sid Harvey stores is what I call the white book. It's an 8.5 by 11 instruction manual. It's probably 3/8 of an inch thick. I think it costs $20, and it teaches you everything you want to know about maintaining a furnace. You buy the $20 book, you look at those diagrams, very nicely done stick figure diagrams, and it tells you exactly how everything is supposed to work. Brand names, it shows you pictures of various brand names of the actual oil burning assembly, if you know what I mean. As I said, it's not rocket science, and you have to do something fairly dumb to get yourself in trouble with that. You got to be a little bit careful about, just like the high voltage inside your transmitter, you don't want to touch it. You don't want to touch the 110 volts that goes to the repeater.
Time out.
You want to be careful about the wiring of your furnace. You want to make sure you pull the main fuse, so to speak, of the furnace, or you flip the big red switch before you do any service on it, and so on. There's a couple of very logical things you do for human safety, but maintaining it is not that difficult. Looks to me like you're not going to get an answer tonight, Joe, although I think in my spare time I'm going to look up how many BTU you get per X number of cubic feet of natural gas. What is
the word therm, Dick?
Yeah, the word. Okay, a therm, I think, is a particular volume of gas. Is that true, Paul? WS2N? Go right ahead with what do you know on the subject. K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2CUX.
TUX recognized with Paul. Go ahead, Paul.
WS2N. I think he's looking at therm, which is, it's 100,000 BTUs. So, the gas meter measures, the volume of gas that goes through the system. You get up to 100, I think it's 100 cubic feet of gas that goes through, and that gives you 100,000 BTUs. So I guess you can convert that. You'd have to figure out what you're paying per therm, T-H-E-R-M. I have oil heat here, but I'm just going what I remember about the gas days. Back to you, Dick.
E2-CWZ. CWZ, you're right after TUX. You guessed that 100,000 cubic feet is 100,000 BTU. 1 BTU per cubic foot.
No, Dick.
You said those words, but what did you mean to say? Paul, go ahead.
That's this cold I'm trying to shake. 100,000 BTUs would be the equivalent of 100 cubic feet of gas that goes through. That's what I'm saying.
Are you telling me that each cubic feet is exactly 1,000 BTU? That's an overly coincidental set of numbers. Over to you on that one, Paul.
I never thought of it like that, but a therm is considered 100,000 BTUs. So, if you're going to pay, X amount of dollars for a therm, whatever it is, that means you're going to eat up 100 cubic feet of natural gas that's going to go through.
You keep relating them that way, and we're going to have to double check on that. Now, I probably have the first set of call letters incorrect. It sounded like KC2TUX. Please correct me on your call letter, sir, and your name, and proceed with your information. K2LIW, my name is Dick.
Yeah, you have it correct. Kilo Charlie 2, Tango Uniform X-ray. There's an excellent calculator online. It's on pelletheat.org. You put in your cost per ton and dollars of wood pellets, number 2 fuel oil, per gallon, cost per kilowatt hour electricity, natural gas, LP and propane, and hardwood. But the kicker on everything is the appliance efficiency, because obviously, the system you described in your house with the excess exhaust vent, where you're radiating heat off of, you're getting a lot more efficiency out of that, I would imagine. But you type in all of your costs, and it will calculate cost per million BTUs on all of the different types of fuels, including hardwood, which obviously can vary between different types of hardwood. Back to your deck, KC2TUX.
Hi, thank you, Bill. Darn good information. And as I see it, I know the information is there. Ridiculous amount of information is on the internet. Wow. I don't know about you guys, but every so often I'll start looking at space information or the latest things they're discovering in physics or at CERN, and you start looking at these YouTube videos and these articles, and pretty soon a tremendous amount of time is going by, and the family is saying, hey, what's going on? It's hard to resist because some of them are such darn good things. Okay, Mr. CWZ, and I missed your prefix, sir. So give me your prefix and your name. K2RIW, please give us your information. My name is Dick.
Good evening, Dick. It's, name is Phil. Kilo David 2 CWZ, KD2 CWZ. I used to work for Brooklyn Union, so I know something about natural gas. And you already got your answer. A cubic foot of gas is approximately 1,000 BTUs. And he's right, the therm is up. One therm is equal to 100,000 BTUs.
My goodness, Phil, that is overly coincidental as I see it. Ha, the numbers work out. That there isn't even a 0.9 in there, if you know what I mean, or a 0.1. So you're telling me each cubic foot of natural gas is very close to 1,000 BTUs. Wow. Huh. So you can convert therms into cubic feet that easily. And Phil, you probably told us, but I missed it. What's the current number of dollars per therm these days? KD2CWZ, K2RIW TechNet.
I wish I could tell you, but I couldn't. It varies monthly what each company charges for their gas. Comparing it to oil, it's hard to say. I was always taught, oil has a great, it's a hotter flame with oil heat. The heat content of oil is slightly hotter than natural gas. But the price, I couldn't tell you for sure, and I don't want to steal anybody wrong because I'm not exactly sure. But it does vary.